those who despitefully use them. Well, this is a merit. And this is a very hard merit for modern man to take on enthusiastically. Well, how can he expect to take on the whole illusion of the world and work through it to liberation if he cannot take on a small weakness of his own? How does he expect to unfold this wonderful mystery of life within himself if he cannot make a first simple offering at the altar of eternity? So in the book of the Golden Precepts, we find the individual reminded of the three natures of the Buddha himself, and of how these natures are involved in the growth and unfoldment of the disciple. We may say that the arhat body, the arhat is recognized in modern Buddhism, but he is made subordinate to the bodhisattva. In the modern system, the arhat is no longer the solitary soul seeking nirvana. The arhat now becomes a warden in the great house of the mysteries. The arhat is now the custodian. He is now the guru, the great order of the gurus. The arhats are the teachers. They are the disseminators of the doctrine. Therefore, they are the ones who function and continue to function in the lowest of the three bodies, the Vimanakaya. They are the ones who continue the terrestrial forms of things. And in the art of modern Buddhism, the arhats, whether it be the group of 16 or the circle of 500, the arhats are always represented as grave-faced men, some of rather amazing appearance, some rather grotesque, some giving the impression of extreme severity, and others, like some of the Zen patriarchs, really quite happy and good-natured. But they dress in the robes of monks. Their heads are shaven in most cases. And they live in hermitage. They live in the forest, or they walk in the marketplaces. They teach, they serve the sick. They represent the degree of the truth seeker who is dedicated to the first labor of the northern system, and that is growth through common service. These teachers are the dedicated servants of truth, and they claim to be no more than servants. They are also the ones, according to the esoteric tradition, who are supposed to be the guardians of the doctrine of a Buddha, while there is no actual Buddha incarnate in the world. Therefore, the arhats are to continue the administration of worldly affairs from the time of the passing of Gautama to the advent of the Maitreya Buddha. The arhat becomes in Europe the adept, and in the esoteric teaching he is the higher initiate order, composed of those who are the custodians of the secret truths of knowledge, and are also the masters holding the hidden keys to the perfections of all arts and sciences. The alchemical adepts and the Kabbalistic adepts are well known in European literature. They are the masters of wisdom in the old philosophy. They are the hierarchies that in India are represented by the orders of the gurus or teachers. In the modern system, the bodhisattva is no longer represented in these earthly robes. The only bodhisattva who maintains the arhat form or quality is Jizo, the protector of children. He is always represented in priestly vestments and with a shaven head. But all the other bodhisattvas are usually depicted in princely garments as Indian princes, as might have attended together in the court of Magadha in India. They represent, therefore, that period of Gautama Buddha's historical life in which he was Prince of Kapilavastu. In other words, they recapitulate his princely life. They are usually coroneted. They wear more or less Hindu costumes, elaborate jewelry, armbands, anklets. They may have an elaborate petrol on the breast or an elaborate necklace type of ornamentation. They may have heavy pendant earrings. They represent, therefore, beings of splendor such as those found on the tall paintings at Ajanta and Ellora in India, like the great Bodhisattva of the Blue Lotus, at Ajanta. These Bodhisattvas are therefore the princes of the celestial kingdom, referred to in the sutras as young men of good family. They are the higher adept initiates. They are the ones who have gone beyond and are therefore represented in the Sambhogakaya, or the body of enlightenment, the body of luminosity. In art, they are often symbolized as this vehicle that they have, the soul body, the golden wedding garment of St. Paul, and they are nearly always represented with gilded bodies, and usually haloed and throned. They may have the nimbus behind the head, the halo around the body, or a mandala surrounding the entire religious icon. They may be canopied and surrounded by radiant angels in the iconography of the Asiatic countries. In any event, they represent the princes of the invisible empire. They represent the higher adepts, the higher mahatmas, the rishis, the great sages. But in the northern Buddhistic system, they have been separately endowed with certain capacities, and they represent what might be termed the Supreme Council of the Great White Brotherhood. This concept, which we find expounded throughout the northern system, means that the Bodhisattvas are the ones who have achieved the highest attainment that man can achieve, and still retain contact with humanity. Now, the point involved in this is rather interesting also, and it is part of the story in the Voice of the Silence. I think it might be worth mentioning. Man today has actually no awareness of the evolutionary processes taking place within himself. He does not realize that he is himself master over a vast order of living things. That in his bloodstream, muscles, and bones, there are living creatures. Creatures that in their own spheres may be just as conscious as he is. He does not know. Because of their total difference, because he has ascended to a much higher level of complete homogeneous consciousness, he has attained this by losing awareness of them. The human being is no longer capable of extending his consciousness down into a fingernail or into a small area of bone and experiencing the spiritual mystery of the life that is there. For that matter, he cannot reach out around him in nature and experience any creature except himself. He may observe all. He may meditate upon and study many types of life and develop strong sympathies, but he can never identically experience the consciousness of anything except himself. Now, in the ideas of the Northern School, the Bodhisattva has ascended far beyond the ordinary consciousness of man, and the next step would be that he could no longer recall his own humanity. He could no longer be again one with the world he has left behind. One more step, and he would be incapable of pain. One more step and he could no longer know sorrow. One more step and he could not walk beside misery with great compassion in his heart. But if he went any further, the mysterious workings of the law itself would lift his consciousness to a degree in which he could no longer tune in the miseries of the ignorant. There would come a point in going upward and onward when something of the law has to be dropped off. It is also pointed out in the Eastern wisdom that this happens in the development of extrasensory perception gamuts. While the individual develops a higher sensory perception, he must drop off one of the lower ones. He cannot bridge beyond a certain amount. If he does, he then creates too much conflict, too much division within himself. He cannot hold together more than a certain number of octaves of consciousness within his own being. So the Bodhisattva has to decide, as he stands in the radiant Sambhoga body, whether he is going to go any further or not. If he does decide to go further, he is forced to relinquish the world. The only other step for him now would be to step through into the Nirvana. He would have to go on. But at the moment of the great decision, he does not have to go on. He can voluntarily renounce his own attainment in order to become more and more involved in the suffering of mankind. And the whole great order of the Bodhisattvas in the modern system, and according to this system, there are legions moving in from other planets, from other suns, from all dimensions of space, these radiant golden figures. These beings who are still selves by an act of will. We have each and every one of them voluntarily relinquished the great peace. Have given up the end of suffering. We have voluntarily chose to remain in sympathetic psychic bond with the sorrow of the world. They have so made this decision in order that they may become this great band of servers, as they were called. They are therefore the great physicians of the soul. They are the teachers and the leaders who have resolved to remain with this one flaw left in themselves. If they reject this one illusion, they can no longer stay. And the question is, what error is it that they hold on to? Not because they have to, but because by so doing, they set in motion the karma which perpetuates their own bondage, and that is their intention. They have to be wrong in something. They choose to be wrong in something. Because by so doing, as an act of choice, having the vision, the wisdom, and the integration to go on, they still choose not to. And the thing that holds them, the binding thing which they cling to, and which keeps them in the world, is love. It is this deep, overwhelming compassion for life, this great feeling of the need of another, in this case, the need of mankind. And they remain firmly resolved in themselves, however, that this love is in a sense a defiance of law. But to the Bodhisattva, this defiance is a new definition of law. For to him, law and the law become the same thing. But he willfully and intentionally remains behind as an instrument of a vicarious atonement which he knows does not exist. He knows in ill all that he cannot save any other living thing. And yet he dedicates himself to that task. He dedicates himself to that task because his heart wins the victory over his reason. And in this mystery, he simply assumes voluntarily a relation of parenthood toward life. It does not mean that he will never achieve liberation, but it means that he will wait to make sure that all else precedes him, that he will not enter into peace as long as suffering exists in the world. Suffering exists only because ignorance exists. Suffering exists only because of the weakness in man in relationship to the recognition of truth. Therefore, it is the duty and responsibility of the Bodhisattva to act as the living bridge, to provide out of his own consciousness the hope for those who do not have as yet the strength to achieve in their own right. He therefore becomes the great teacher, the initiator, the redeemer, and the releaser. Yet he is not a god. He is not a messiah, nor does he act with the authority of any deity. He is not one who has come because he is predestined or foreordained to come. He is not primarily answering the prayer of a suffering humanity. He has taken the Bodhisattva obligation for one reason only. In his heart, he could do nothing else. This was his only motive. He does it because in his heart, the happiness, security, peace, and well-being of all other living things is more important than his own. Now, this can be rationalized to one step further. In doing this, in the Sambhoga body, what happens? Theoretically, in this stage or in this degree of consciousness, the Bodhisattva has suddenly realized that this world he is coming back to serve is also himself. The Sambhoga body, the luminous sphere, means that he has diffused himself throughout all life, realizing this life's identity with his own. Instead of being now one upon whom men move or turn, or one who in turn gazes down upon a suffering world, the Bodhisattva takes on the world. Instead of the Nirvana or the great liberation, it voluntarily takes on the great bondage, diffusing itself through all that lives for the redemption of all that lives and itself. This is the northern concept of the great unselfishness, that the individual who makes this sacrifice, strangely enough, does it not only for the redemption of the imperfection of the world and the redemption of itself, but also for the redemption of those who have passed to the Nirvana by the act of the Southern School. In other words, the Bodhisattva also redeems the Nirvanic plane itself. He acts in the place of those who have chosen to go on of their own accord to their own achievement. He cannot prevent this or change it. He has no right to it. But he takes their place as well as his own, and in so doing permeates the entire sphere of existence. Thus it is believed that as the Bodhisattvas disappear from the world, they reappear in the human heart. Their goal or key becomes part of the consciousness of all that lives, and the innerness of things, the dimension of liberation in man, is enriched by the presence of all who have achieved liberation. Now, in the northern school, it is also said that the Gautama Buddha, though he is believed to have attained the Paramabhava and to have entered the great peace or the great silence, actually, according to the northern school, only passed from this world of physical things to an invisible state. As far as his disciples were concerned, as far as they knew, he had achieved the absolute dissolution of his own existence. But the modern school says that he did not. But what he actually did was to take on this Sambhoga body again. That Buddha himself, therefore, became, in the moment of nirvana, not only an emancipated soul, but voluntarily reassumed the bodhisattva state. Therefore, could be diffused throughout the universe again. Now, if you ask for proof of this from the older Buddha writings, then we are reminded that according to the teachings, once the Buddha has ended karma, which Gautama did, and has entered the Parinirvana, he cannot ever return for any reason. Yet the Buddha died, fulfilled the meditation, completed the karma, according to his own words, entered the Parinirvana. And then, having entered the Parinirvana, returned, reanimated his body, and preached his last sermon to his mother. Now, something is wrong in thinking. Because if he had actually attained dissipation of body, if at the moment of the samadhi, which is described in the Maha Parinirvana Sutta, he could not have returned for any reason. Even one instant later, he could not have returned. Yet not only does the modern school say that he returned, and does not only the old Pali scriptures, which belong to the Southern school, also say that he returned, but the esoteric teachings of both schools say that he was re-embodied as Sankaracharya. So that the story, as the modern system is, that Gautama himself reassumed the Sambhoga Kaya, or the body of light, and continued to overshadow his arhats and bodhisattvas. This is preserved in the northern school in the symbolism of the creation of the eastern paradise of Gautama. That in the great mural paintings that were in the Kondo of Ayuji, which were burned, unfortunately, but of which adequate copies are preserved, the four great paradise regions are established. The fourth of these is the paradise of the East, which is presided over by the Buddha Gautama, who therefore is creating his own heavenly region to be embodied or to be inhabited by his bodhisattvas and arhats, which are really only fragments of himself. Now, the modern school goes much more profoundly into the transphysical aspects of these matters. Also, in the Lotus Sutra, there is the famous vision of the stupa. Now, the vision of the stupa is the vision of a tower. And when the gathering of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and the Arhats and the great brothers and the great sisters, the nuns, led by the mother and the stepmother of Gautama, in this vast assembly, which extends to the furthest corners of space, is all there. There suddenly descends from the sky a pagoda, or stupa, a monument, a mortuary monument. Seated in it, the vision or body of the preceding extinct Buddha, which is expressly referred to as the extinct Buddha. This being motions to Amida to come and sit with him in the pagoda. And the two have converse there, Amida and the extinct Buddha. There is one possible explanation to that, namely, that as far as the northern system is concerned, the nirvana does not signify extinction. Or extinction does not mean what we think it does. Rather, it means universalization. It means the expansion of a life beyond the identity of selfness into the identity of allness. And the pagoda, in this case, is the universe itself, which is the tower, monument, or shrine, carrying within it all of the Buddhas that have had historical existence in this world. Many pictures of them are found on the cave walls in Turkestan, the whole sequence of them, in the caves of Penglong in Chinese Turkestan. So in the northern system, which H.P. Blavatsky favored, you find the groundwork for the development of her own specialized interpretation of the esoteric schools, an interpretation somewhat influenced by Tibetan thinking, but largely the result of simple Mahayana logic, in which the universe becomes, so to say, this great field of experience. Each level becomes a degree of insight. The individual passes through tests, initiations, and disciplines, rising gradually from the state of ordinary human consciousness to the arhat and to the bodhisattva levels of illumination or enlightenment. Having achieved the bodhisattva state, the being then begins to prepare the mysterious region of salvation over which it will preside, as in the case of the Buddha Amida, who took the obligation, when a bodhisattva, to create the Western paradise. So the bodhisattva takes the obligation to create the region of the redeemed, and then gathers to himself, as his obligation, all life within the area of his consciousness. We will get back to the corollaries and so forth, you see. So in this sense, in the case, for instance, of Kongnam, we have a certain color significance. And this color significance is important, because the bodhisattva is responsible for that order of life which derives from its own ray or belongs to it. The ray of Amida is red. Therefore, this red ray, or the red light, signifies that degree of cosmic life color over which the paradise of the West has control, and which will bring to it all of these entities. Those in the northern system, all of these points are very carefully and very clearly unfolded. H.P. Blavatsky, in this Voice of the Silence, also, therefore, leads plainly to the primary subject or theme, which is the voice of the silence. All of this has to do, therefore, with the power of the individual to experience the mystery of the final instruction. In achieving this mystery, the use of the esoteric instruments may also be mentioned. I think there is no place in the literature up to her time of Orientalism in which there is as clear an insight as to the great ceremonial magic of the Northern School. Here the magic that we still find in the symbolism in Japan of the Shingon and the Tendai. In fact, much of her information in this little book would almost imply that she was aware of these sects and their function in modern times. And there is a belief and pretty good evidence that Madame Blavatsky was in Japan for at least a short time. In any event, she brings out very clearly the whole great ritualistic theory. She points out, for example, that the double thunderbolt, the Vajra, the mysterious flaming scepter, the double crown scepter, which is carried by the Shingon and Tendai abbots, that this is a symbol of the syllables of the sacred name or the word. That the mysterious bird that carries the initiate to heaven is made up of this name also, with one letter on each wing and the third letter forming the body and tail. The use of all such symbolism as this to indicate the development of the esoteric doctrine implies the gradual achievement of certain yogic processes and practices for the achievement of these mystical ends. We will take up the yogic aspect of it next week, but I think we should point out that in Tantra and Yoga, you do have exact scientific methods. In other words, you can get yourself into the same dilemma exactly in these that the world got itself into when it invented nuclear fission. Scientifically, if the knowledge is available, you can split the atom. Scientifically, if the knowledge is available, you can create with your skill either instruments of universal destruction or perhaps instruments of universal salvation. Therefore, in yoga and in tantra, you have a skill which can be developed. And what happens to that skill, and what happens because of it, which is determined entirely by the integrity of the disciple. If the disciple, gaining the mechanical power to perform these mysteries of skill, is not at the same time adequately established in the mysteries of the golden precepts, is not firmly set in the path of absolute integrity, he will use skill to destroy himself and destroy others. He cannot be prevented from learning the secrets of life. But with these secrets of life, he will kill himself if he does not develop within his own nature the complete knowledge of the laws of how to use knowledge. And this is, again, part of the very important instruction. Now, it should be remembered that in the final analysis of things, we must assume, as H.P.B. does, that the Mahayana is the heart doctrine, that the final tabernacle, the great pagoda, is in the heart. And in the heart sits forever the radiant form of the Dhyana Buddha. In the heart also is the magnificent symbol of the Virakana Buddha, or the Dainichi Nyorai, the great eternal sun consciousness being. It is this inner thing that is actually the axis of man's existence. And as the result of the northern concept, the rays and powers of the redeemed have all focused into the heart of man. And here, therefore, we have the great hierarchy governing all things from within themselves, with the heart as the mysterious Shambhala resting on the top of the great diaphragm muscle of the Gobuna or Mount Meru. In the Vedic anatomy and physiology, the relationship of all parts of the body to the structure of the universe, this relationship is indicated and very clearly set forth. For our present purpose, however, what we really need to point out is that the final instruction, the final initiation, comes from the self-initiator in the heart. But finally, the gurus are no longer great enough. The gurus cannot firmly initiate the individual. The guru can only prepare the individual by providing him with the means for the regeneration of his own nature. Having achieved this, the next step happens. But the guru is not responsible for the final keys of knowledge or for the communication of the mysterious secret name, which is the true name of reality. This can only be communicated by the heart, which whispers to the ear the secret of salvation. Therefore, in the story of the Book of the Golden Precepts, the dweller in the heart that remains forever, is the mysterious power, being or principle, substance, essence, or life, reality, which speaks with the voice of the silence. The great silence is the source of the eternal sound. The Chinese Taoists refer to the great sound as the great kung. It is the sound which men can hear when they have silenced every other sound in themselves. But so far as man is concerned, the sound and the fury have ceased. Then the great kung is heard. When man has transcended all desire, then the voice of the silence speaks. When the individual no longer speaks with his own mind or his own desires or for his own mind or for his own desires, but remains eternally silent in the presence of the tabernacle in the heart, then the eternal speaks through man. But it will not speak while man is speaking. It cannot be heard above the sound of the fury which man himself creates. Thus always the final instruction is the way to achieve this remarkable, this mysterious, this truly wonderful inner silence. For all the powers of knowledge, all the questings and searchings of existence must lead in the end to complete peace. Plato had the same concept exactly, except that to him, this silence he called faith. And faith is silence, because it is the end of doubting, and doubting is noise, sound, confusion. The individual who has perfect faith asks no more, asks no questions, demands no answers. The individual who has found perfect faith has found silence in himself. For sound in him is fear. Sound in him is the endless working of those lesser faculties which disturb the serenity of consciousness. Well, whether it be in the Platonic system or in modern Buddhism, the principle is the same. But the goal is to achieve the great quietude, the quietude of the perfect acceptance, the quietude of the quiet acceptance of situations that can never be in any way disturbed. Quietude is the inability of inharmony to rise any longer within the person, because the roots of inharmony have been taken out. It is as though the mysterious vine and fiber of confusion have been cut with the sword of quick detachment. It is as though truly that man has slain the slayer of the real. For this slayer of the real is always the power of unreality to control feeling, thought, and action. So the person who has finally achieved this mysterious sense of transcendency, inasmuch as there is nothing left in the world to dislike, there is nothing left of ourselves to want, to desire, to demand, or to command. There is no longer desire to be like anything or to change anything. Only the realization that the infinite plan is working infinitely and that all things are inevitably going to come well. In the silence of this complete acceptance and this complete confidence comes the voice of the silence. Now, the voice of the silence arising within the stillness of man is described in ancient Eastern symbolism as a mysterious radiant fiat arising, floating, hovering above the great sea of timeless eternity, where the individuality was returned to the ocean of the infinite. And this great silence is always in the beginning of things. And in the opening verses of Genesis, there was the deep, without shape, without form, and void. And there was the Spirit of Elohim moving upon the face of the waters. And in the modern Buddhistic concept, this is also the same thing. Where in the absolute inner silence, the mysterious powers, the mysterious situation, the three tremendous syllables of the eternal word, move upon the face of the quietude of man's deepness. And in that moment, the fiat is spoken. The voice of silence thunders. And in that instant, a creation is born. And in that moment, the rare nature of everything that lives or exists is suddenly permeated throughout its entire structure with the lightning flash of the divine fiat. From that moment on, creation is ensouled with the Creator. And from the union of creation and Creator comes forth the infinite diversity of created things. But in this moment that the individual experience of the fiat is concerned with, the voice of the silence, in the instant when this voice is heard, in that moment, time receives into itself the fullness of eternity. In that moment, every fragment of existence, so far as that being is concerned, is ablaze with the eternal truth of things. Infinite life has revealed itself through its manifestation and has been restored to its own identity. So in the idea of the voice of the silence, we have three different levels actually concerned. The voice of the silence is man listening to the first silence that he can know, conscience. It is the individual listening to the voice of the better in his own heart, following the dictates of the nobility of character which he may be urged to compromise every day. But when a person does what is not right, he knows this in himself, even though he may play ignorant. The second silence is the silence of prayerful meditation, the degree of receptivity in which the individual opens his sick, sorrowful, tired nature to receive into it the medicine of the Spirit. For it is in that moment of silence, reaching out into the unknown for hope, that man discovers the true meaning of the Comforter, the power that abides in space to bring peace to those who seek. Then these become in turn the symbols of the final reaching out of consciousness to receive the final instruction, to receive to itself the perfect meaning of things. And the voice of the silence is finally the name of integrity. It is the infinite revealing its own infinity to the finite and establishing the true relationship between all that lives. Pilate asked Jesus what is truth, and Jesus was silent. But in the great silence that follows the clamorings of the world, the truth seeker receives the answer to his question. What is truth? The world cannot answer. Man cannot answer that if the one who asks the question is worldly. It is only when the unworldly asks of the unworldly, and at that moment in which the alone requests of that which is forever alone, the answer. That the mysterious communication, the impact of ultimate reality is possible. And this impact of ultimate reality is the voiceless voice. The voice that is not heard, the voice that speaks in silence, the voice of the great silence itself, which is also found in the Zen mysteries. The great void, the mystery of the vacuity itself. For in the great void there is no void. In the great silence we hear indeed the music of the spheres. In the silence of man's complete acceptance. In the silence of the unquestioning heart. In the silence that has learned to be still and know. There is the direct impact of eternal knowledge upon the truth seeker. It has been called cosmic consciousness, illumination, enlightenment. But it is the one answer to the one question that comes out of silence. And in answering the one question, it is the answer to all questions. This is the metaphysics, we might say, of the modern system. And in my estimation, this is what is really the essential substance of the Book of the Golden Precepts. And it has been, I think, rather beautifully set forth in the fragments which Madame Blavatsky collected and called The Voice of the Silence. Well, that is all we can do this evening, folks, so thank you very much.